Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. They say you don't need to be Irish to celebrate today, but when I was growing up in the Twin Cities, it seemed to me like it was still an Irish holiday. Apparently, it never was. My grandfather, O.F. Willius, for Oscar Ferdinand, who was from a prominent German immigrant family with a Latinized surname, was born on this day, and he was nicknamed and always called Pat, because, really, Oscar Ferdinand? Grandpa Pat was my mother's adoptive father. My mom, who was actually only about one quarter German, always pointed out to me that we were Scotch-Irish, orange-Irish, meaning Protestant rather than Catholic, and therefore we should wear orange, not green, on St. Paddy's Day. I do have some green on me, though. St. Patrick's, it seems, according to our reading from Thomas Cahill's How the Irish Saved Civilization, was the reason that the Irish became the saviors of all that was worthy and cultured after the fall of Rome in the 5th century. Cahill is a fabulous storyteller as he shares the untold story of Ireland's heroic role from the fall of Rome to the rise of medieval Europe. Cahill notes that the word Irish is seldom coupled with the word civilization. And yet, Ireland, a little island at the edge of Europe that has known neither Renaissance nor Enlightenment, in some ways a third world country with, as John Betjeman claimed, a Stone Age culture, had one moment of unblemished glory. As they say, Rome wasn't built in a day, but nor did it fall in one day. The Visigoths first invaded and overran Rome in 410 of the Common Era, and Romulus, the last emperor of Rome, was overthrown in 476. The man who became known as St. Patrick lived during the decades of Rome's demise. We cannot be certain of Patrick's birth or death, only that he lived during the 5th century. Patricius was born into and grew up in a British Roman family within a Roman civitas, or favored provincial city-state. At 16, he was abducted and forced to spend his youth as a shepherd slave in Ireland. The sketchy details of his life suggest that he turned to prayer, despite not really believing in God and not having paid much attention to the teachings of his religion, petitioning God to help him, coming to rely on the Spirit within to sustain him. His spiritual life grew very strong. After enduring 6 years in servitude, and as a result of a mystical experience, Patricius set out for his boyhood home in Britain, becoming a fugitive slave. Unable to get the Irish out of his mind, Patrick eventually returns to Ireland as an apostle to the Irish nation. Patrick was the first missionary. Because of the timing of his exile, Patrick lacked a formal Roman education. However, he recognized the value of learning and literacy. Again, as Cahill explains, it was Patrick's Christian mission that nurtured Irish scholarship into blossom. Patrick, the incomplete Roman, nevertheless understood that though Christianity was not inextricably wedded to Roman custom, it could not survive without Roman literacy. And so the first Irish Christians also became the first Irish literates. Cahill continues, Ireland is unique in religious history for being the only land into which Christianity was introduced without bloodshed. There are no Irish martyrs. Not until much later in history, anyway. Apparently, this didn't sit well with the 5th century Irish, who felt that a violent death made for an exciting finale to the martyrologies from which they were learning to read. The Irish of the 5th century and early 6th centuries soon found a solution, which they called the Green Martyrdom, opposing it to the Red Martyrdom by blood, writes Cahill. The Green Martyrs became monks, basing their wished-for extremes on the examples of the Desert Fathers, and I might add Desert Mothers, though surely they didn't have the opportunity to read about women anchorites. Living alone in isolated hermitages in Egypt, the Green Martyrdom was therefore the root of the monastic movement. It was nothing like the antisocial isolation of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. Cahill explains that since Ireland had no cities, these monastic establishments grew rapidly into the first population centers, hubs of unprecedented prosperity, art, and learning. The Irish monks began to copy the books. They also wrote notes in the margins and poetry and made doodles. They decorated their new pages with initial capital letters and beautifully scripted headings. Devising an Irish grammar, they wrote their own native oral tradition into new works. Once they got the hang of these tasks, the Irish began to make up languages, not unlike the made-up languages of modern authors such as James Joyce and J.R.R. Tolkien. The role of the Irish in saving civilization lies not only in the fact that Irish monastics were preserving the ancient Roman and Greek texts during the middle or medieval age, those 1,000 years or so between the fall of Rome and the Renaissance, a time often referred to as the Dark Ages because there was little scientific or cultural advancement in Europe. Their inherent playfulness introduced other changes to these religious societies that rippled outward into the general cultural context as well. Soon enough, says Cahill, cityless Ireland altered, without quite meaning to, the political structure of Christianity. Lacking cities, Ireland didn't quite see the point of bishops, and gradually these were replaced in importance by abbots. And in a development that would make any self-respecting Roman's blood run cold, abbesses. Brigide of Kildare, whom Patrick had converted to Christianity, for example, ruled over a double monastery that admitted both men and women. Brigide is also purported to have had druidical associations. Mixing pagan and Christian practices together. Not surprising, really. As native cultures that have had Christianity forced upon them often use the colonizers' religious rituals in a way that subverts the dominating practice and maintains the native spiritual beliefs underneath. Cahill does caution the reader or listener of his Irish herstory that it would be an overstatement to claim that women possessed equality in Irish society, but their larger presence here ensured a greater stress on physical amenities and on the value of intimacy. This larger female presence also contributed to the teeming variety of Irish religious life. In Ireland, the act of confession became a private matter, unlike the requirement for public confession of one's sins on the European continent. This Irish innovation was to make all confession a completely private affair between penitent and priest, and to make it as repeatable as necessary. It did away with public humiliation. But it also emphasized the Irish sense that personal conscience took precedence over public opinion or church authority. The penitent was not labeled by others, he labeled himself. His sin was no one's business but God's. The Irish twist on this is that you chose your confessor as a soul friend. You chose as your confessor a soul friend, an anamkara, to be your priest. This had to be a person you could trust for your lifetime. Irish monasteries wrote respect for differences into their rule books, and the rules therein were suggested, they did not enforce. It reminds me of our promise to hold each other accountable through calling back to our covenant, whether the congregational covenant of right relations or our covenant to affirm and promote the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. Thomas Cahill opines, "It is a shame that private confession is one of the few Irish innovations that passed into the universal church. How differently might Catholicism be today if it had taken over the easy Irish sympathy between churchmen and laymen and the easy Irish attitudes towards diversity, authority, the role of women, and the relative unimportance of sexual mores." It didn't happen that way at all, but it is because of a 6th century Irish monk named Columbkill that feuding medieval kingdoms in Europe would again become civilized societies. The Irish monastic tradition spread in part through the foreign students they hosted, but more significantly through what Cahill calls the white martyrdom. Irish monks colonized barbarian Europe, beginning with Scotland, a variant of Scotty, which is actually a Latin name for the Irish. The Scots and the Irish are one family. This isn't the end of the story that Thomas Cahill tells, but I'm going to leave it there. The history of the Irish people winds down other roads as time progresses towards the present, and I want to leave myself enough time to talk about one of those turnings in the second part of the sermon. First, however, let us rise in body or spirit to sing hymn number 20, "Be Thou My Vision." The text of this Irish Christian poem might have been written as early as the 6th century. The words can be found in your gray hymnals, and technical delay. It will be projected on the wall, I hope. All right, so rise in body and spirit, hymn number 20. The history of a group of people or a nation is never all life-affirming or all negative. It's a mixed bag. The history of the Irish has positive aspects such as the preservation of ancient texts and the later dissemination of that information once again across the European continent, as we have just learned. And Irish culture, like human societies globally, has evolved from earlier forms that relied heavily on violence and warfare to acquire and protect resources. From this to social systems where peaceful negotiation and market capitalism dominate our interactions. In Europe and the British Isles, Ireland experienced only a brief heyday of prestige among the elite and owning classes. Much more often, the Irish, in particular the heirs of St. Patrick's missionary goal to convert the Irish to Roman Catholic Christianity, were the oppressed group of people in their native land. Last fall, I came across a book called How the Irish Became White by Noel Ignatieff. He's a rather controversial figure, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants and a Marxist communist who advocates for the abolishment of the social construct of race. Since I had read Learning to Be White, Money, Race, and God in America by Tandeika as part of my ministerial formation and found her thesis compelling, I thought it would be interesting to wade into Ignatieff's dissertation, which was written 4 years before Tandeika's book was published in 1999. The UUA's website describes the Reverend Dr. Tandeika as one of the most influential Unitarian Universalist theologians, as well as a journalist and congregational consultant who leads the We Love Beyond Belief project. Ignatieff's work specifically focuses on the question of how the Catholic Irish, an oppressed race in Ireland, became part of an oppressing race in America. It is an attempt to reassess immigrant assimilation and the formation or non-formation of an American working class. He explains, "The Irish who emigrated to America in the 18th and 19th centuries were fleeing caste oppression and a system of landlordism that made material conditions of the Irish peasant comparable to those of an American slave. They came to a society in which color was important in determining social position. It was not a pattern they were familiar with, and they bore no responsibility for it. Nevertheless, they adapted to it in short order. According to Ignatieff, Ireland had an old anti-slavery tradition going back to the Council of Armagh in 1177, which prohibited Irish trade in English slaves. It was a common boast that in seven centuries, no slave had set foot on Irish soil. Nevertheless, 18th century Ireland presents a classic case of racial oppression. Catholics were known as native Irish, Celts or Gaels, as well as Papists and other equally derogatory names, and were regarded and frequently spoke of themselves as a race rather than a nation. This hierarchy of race and class was perpetuated by the Presbyterian Scotch-Irish middle class. Race and class were basically interchangeable, and the right to rule was assigned to supposedly racially superior groups whose status was above the poor. The earliest Irish immigrants to America were Protestants, not Catholics, and farmers and small tradespeople, not the destitute Irish Catholic peasantry who arrived later, especially at the time of the Irish potato famine. It wasn't until the mid-19th century that the Catholic Irish immigrant population became large enough here to influence politics in this country. The Scotch-Irish insisted upon differentiating between descendants of earlier immigrants from Ireland and more recent arrivals. They called themselves nativists. Thus, a proportion of the Irish diaspora became known as the Irish, a racial but not ethnic line invented in Ireland, was recreated as an ethnic but not racial line in America. Tondeika points out that as early as 1670 in the Virginia Commonwealth, people of color and indigenous were forbidden from owning Christian, that is to say white, servants. Successive laws allowed white Christians to whip enslaved people of color and forbade the whipping of Christian white servants. Still later, when whites were released from servitude, it was required that they be given land, money, food, and clothing with which to start a new life as free people. This was not so for freed slaves. By means of such race laws, Virginia's ruling class systematically gave their blessing to lower class whites, whom they nevertheless considered the scruff and scum of England, and who now, free in the colonies after indentured servitude, were thought of as the rabble of Virginia. White supremacy and slavery have always been about economics. And sadly, as Ignatieff points out, white supremacy was not a flaw in American democracy, but part of its definition. And the development of democracy in the Jacksonian period, from 1824 to 1840, cannot be understood without reference to white supremacy. Unfortunately, as Ignatieff points out, the truth is not, as some historians would have it, that slavery made it possible to extend to the Irish the privileges of citizenship by providing another group for them to stand on, but the reverse, that assimilation of the Irish into the white race made it possible to maintain slavery. It was politics, party politics, in fact. As you no doubt are aware, American presidential and legislative campaigns during the middle 1800s was heavily embroiled in the question of slavery and its abolishment. In the course of his book, Ignatieff contrasts the sentiments expressed by leaders of Ireland's abolitionist movement with the changing attitudes and status of Irish immigrants in America as they attempted to get the Irish Americans onto the American and European abolitionist bandwagons. In turn, the abolitionists in America maximized on the use of Catholic Irishman Daniel O'Connell's name, for example, in their effort to influence the sizable Irish-American voting bloc to weigh in against slavery's continuation in the United States. There's a whole lot more in this dissertation about labor unions and so on and so forth, and it's too much to get into. Today, we are wrangling over the system of white supremacy and what constitutes a humane and workable immigration policy. Our nation, founded on the ideals of a democratic society, falls short again and again. It isn't just the Irish who were subjected to bias, although they certainly make an instructive case in point. Each new wave of immigrants faces discrimination. In northern New England, it was Catholic Franco-Americans who were discriminated against by the Anglo-Protestant mill owners. Italian Catholic immigrants in New York and Boston and Philadelphia faced discrimination. And Polish Catholics in these cities, as well as Chicago and other Midwestern population centers, also encountered ethnic bias. In fact, in this century, when a new immigrant population, the Somalis, came to Maine, it was the Franco-Americans who discriminated against them. We all know of the signs such as "Irish need not apply," which turned Irish Catholics away from employment in a way that was similar to, although not the same as, barring people of color from jobs, housing, accommodations, and all manner of other public activities. When they first arrived, the Irish, that is, Irish Catholics, were seen as no better than enslaved African Americans. At some point during the Irish migration to U.S. soil, it wasn't unusual in the South for Irish laborers to be employed where it did not make sense to risk the life of a slave. After all, the slave owners were financially invested in keeping their slaves alive, and the Irish immigrant was a free person who had to be paid for their labor. At first, the Irish were not considered white, although they were not landed, they had not landed in America as captives or hostages. Ignatieff suggests that while the white skin made the Irish eligible for membership in the white race, it did not guarantee their admission. They had to earn it. Pandeyaka posits, on the other hand, that it was and is more about learning than earning. As she writes in the preface to her book, no one is born white in America. The first racial victim of the white community is its own child. And racist acts are sometimes not motivated by white racist sentiment, but by feelings of personal shame. Tandeka has recently written some very provocative blogs about the impact of white supremacy on white people. She suggests, in language I can't use from the pulpit, that this endemic system of oppression has basically made all of us enslaved people. We are all impacted by the ideas and actions of those who came before us. While we may not overtly discriminate against people of color or indigenous people, we are inextricably part of the white supremacist system in which we live and breathe. It is of utmost importance that we be attentive to how we participate in that system of oppression. It is critical that when an event happens, such as the mass shootings of two mosques in New Zealand this past week, that we offer our heartfelt support to our Muslim neighbors, as some of you reached out to do. Our Latinx neighbors also need our support. I became aware this past week of the petty anti-Latinx sentiments expressed by people in the neighborhood I live in when I received 3 see it, click it reports complaining about activities of neighbors and dismissively stating that the people in question were Latino. When you can, interrupt the microaggressions you witness, as long as it is safe for you to do so. As Unitarian Universalists, we have made promises to recognize that we are part of an interconnected and interdependent web of existence, and to uphold the importance of every being. By living out our 7 principles, we make real the covenant of our shared faith tradition. In so doing, the Holy Spirit, that universal love that graces us all, will never be far away. We turn now to music and song. May you succeed on your road. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face, the rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of their hand. Our chalice extinguishing words. We extinguish this chalice, for the worship has ended. Our service begins.